Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. If you've ever ordered an oat milk latte, you've probably tasted the work of Stuart Forsyth, co-founder of Minor Figures. Stuart went from Melbourne's cafe scene to Keep Cup, the world's first barista standard reusable coffee cup, and then on to co-founding Minor Figures, which is now one of the most recognisable plant-based beverages in the world. And from almost nothing, it's grown into a juggernaut. In July 2025, for example, Grojo estimated that Minor Figures has about $34.6 million in annual revenue with 128 employees worldwide. It's a very long way from the coffee shop. Stuart and I talked about how the business scaled so quickly, how it weathered the great oat milk shortage, and why he thinks oat milk is the biggest story in coffee. And don't forget to sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which has lots of insights into entrepreneurialism, analysis, and the beverage industry. You'll find it at drinksinsider.com. Stuart, thank you so much for joining me. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Great pleasure to be on Drinks Insider.
Thank you. Rightio. So what an interesting story. You were working for a coffee company started by your siblings and then you got the idea for Minor Figures. Can you tell the story from the start?
Yeah, I guess if we go to the way, way back machine, the sort of origins, I'm, as you can hear from my accent, perhaps yours too, Felicity.
That's
I'm
right.
An Aussie. Coming from Melbourne, so a town that through the sort of late 90s and early 2000s was absolutely obsessed with coffee and sort of exporting a coffee culture around the world, which was a very interesting and kind of dynamic experience and time period. And I was working in and out of cafes as I was traveling and coming back to the coffee industry. And I, my brother and sister at the time had a chain of cafes in Melbourne, and they wanted to look at reusable coffee cups. So we began the process of creating Keep Cup, which started very simply as a simple idea, which was to create a sustainability idea, which was to create a travel mug in the same size and shape as paper cups. That was really what it came down to. Travel mugs traditionally happened to be giant, big buckets, and someone would come in and ask for a cappuccino and you would not know what to charge. You would not know how much coffee to put in or how much milk or anything like this. So making it in the same size and shape as paper cups meant that from the barista side, from the cafe side, the behind the bar side, it was very easy to use. And the product just really exploded when it took off. And I came to the UK almost months after it started. And we started to get interest from the UK. So I was in London at the time traveling. The interest came in from several big coffee roasters and a couple of big cafe chains. And I began to explore the possibility of Keep Cup here in the UK and
Europe.
Can I
just interrupt? So when was this? What year was this?
This was 2010.
Right. Okay. So the Australians had started to transform London's coffee scene by then.
Not quite.
Yeah,
I would say no. I would say at that time there was still probably two or three cafes in the whole of London which you would consider specialty. Gwilym Davies, a quite famous barista, was still on a coffee cart at that stage. He went on from working on a coffee cart in East London to winning the World Barista Championships. So it was a very interesting and very, very dynamic time. It just was about to kick off. So, and again, a lot of Aussies, a lot of Kiwis involved.
Yeah,
in that.
I remember walking around the financial district and there would be boards out saying Australian barista, like it was a sign of something good. So I interrupted you. So you were in the UK and people were interested in this cup, and then what happened?
Well, the product again, I mean, nothing's easy, but the product, we, you know, pushed the product out. And again, at that time, a very dynamic, once again, it was sort of being at the forefront or at the start of a very dynamic coffee industry. It was an unbelievable time to be in London. Great coffee roasters, great coffee, great cafes, wonderful community, absolutely exploding, really coming, a lot of it coming out of East London. Again, I've sort of come back full circle because Square Mile, who helped us with our start probably at the time, Square Mile Roasters, they're now across the road from Minor Figures where we are in East London at the minute. So quite funny how some of the communities all hung together, but that happened. The cup became, again, sort of iconic within the specialty coffee space. And, yeah, we had a really good run, just an unbelievable experience with that product. And I sold my shares back to my brother and sister in 2014, 2015, and really started Minor Figures then. The original idea was to create a super nice iced coffee that was sort of taking all the simplicity and the provenance and the quality and the care of specialty coffee and then trying to put that onto a grocery shelf.
So let's go back even further. What were you doing before you started working in cafes? Were you a student and you just fell into coffee, or how did it happen?
I think everyone falls into coffee if you're from Australia at some point. So, yeah, I think I was probably, I like to joke, a bit of a degenerate. I was traveling a lot at the time, sort of backpacking and doing all that. But I would have been in my early 20s when it all sort of began. So it was post-university and, just looking, finding something, trying to find my way in the world, really.
All right. So we'll go back to 2014. So you've sold your shares. I presume you've got some money and you decide that you're going to launch a new product. What made you decide to do this product, not something else? What was the charm of oat milk?
Well, at the time it was actually iced coffee we were trying to make. So that's where it all began, was with an iced coffee product. And again, cold brew was just kicking off in the US. So we actually went after a cold brew as our original product that came out. And at the time, nobody in Europe had really tried to create a product which was at the scale that we needed to put it on a grocery shelf. So we began a relationship with, you know, contract packers and Tetra Pak, and we were exploring, unlike most cold brews who are very short shelf life, sort of glass bottle, very expensive, we were approaching it from a much more inclusive standpoint, trying to lower the price point and get it, as I said, a wider distribution. And with that comes the big responsibility of the large sort of product runs. So we're making these quite gigantic product runs. We had to make a ton of cold brew at the time. And then we realized quite quickly that as the specialty coffee scene really likes, you know, specialty coffee or filter coffee or pour overs or cold brew, and was more used to innovation and sort of this niching of coffee and quite curious and interested and appreciative of it, the mass market wasn't there. So quite quickly we decided, oh, we better start blending this with different milks, let's say. We didn't really like dairy. As Minor Figures, I don't know if anyone really drinks. We all drink black coffee here. So we began to explore different things. And at the time, there was only really one other plant-based ingredient that worked really well. And we, at the time, to be honest, I sort of put it off. I was a bit like, oh, I'm not sure that's going to take off. Like, that doesn't seem very popular. The US was sort of flirting with coconut at the time. We just really worked and worked and worked on it and just decided that it was the best and possibly even better than milk if it was handled and thought about in the right way. And we pursued, that's how we started to pursue it.
I'll just stop you. Who is the we you're talking about? Was this your siblings or was this business partners?
No, business partners. No, since I left my siblings and we all came out relatively unscathed with not so much PTSD from all working together. I started Minor Figures with two others.
And who are they?
One's name's Will Rickson. He was working in the specialty coffee industry, more of a, certainly a friend of mine and a sort of bon vivant around the scene, quite an incredible character. And then the other one's Jonathan Chu, who, funnily enough, I went to high school with. He was a few years older than me, but we went to high school with. But we regrouped here in London when I came here. He was working for a design agency here. So it was the three of us who started Minor Figures.
So how did it happen? Did we having coffee one day and you went, guys, we've got to get this into grocery shelves? I mean, what was the impetus to go, we're going to do a company called Minor Figures?
So I had returned, so I had sold Minor Figures. I just had a baby. We had lived, my partner's American. We were living in America at the time with a long sort of break with a brand new baby at her parents' place. And we didn't have a place to come back to in London. And I had purchased a mechanics garage, sight unseen, and quickly came back and was scrambling to renovate it so we could move in. So while we were in the US, I sort of started the work, but it all happened very, very fast. And then I came back, I think I came back first and was actually working, building this, the work site into a home. My family came back and we were living in Airbnbs all across sort of London. So it was a very kind of crazy and hectic time. And at that time I was, you know, I think I was screwing some drywall to the ceiling up a giant rickety scaffold with Will, who was at the time a jazz trumpet musician who was sort of between touring, and he was helping me out on site. And I said, look, I think I'm going to start a business. I'd really like this idea of a really premium iced coffee that shares all of the characteristics that you would expect in a specialty coffee shop, but you can get that at your local corner shop. And it'd have to be shelf-stable because I had all this connection to coffee roasters and cafes all across Europe and also America. It would have to be shelf-stable. It would have to be this. It would have to be that. And we sort of put the parameters down. And then he said, oh, well, I'd really like to do that. And I said, oh, man, geez, I don't know if I was only just floating an idea. Don't get too carried away. let's grab this other sheet of drywall. And then we sat on it for a little while, and we sort of mulled it over a smoko, let's say, for a few days in a row. And then I said, look, there's one fella that if I can get him involved, and he says yes, then we'll start the business. So the both of us met Johnny. Will met Johnny for the first time,
You approached him cold. You just said, you look like a great fit for our business.
Yeah.
Come in with us. And what convinced him?
He is completely out of his mind. That's what convinced him. I didn't realize that. I wouldn't have had him as a business partner if I had known how crazy he was. But no, he went away and very thoughtful as he is as a character, incredibly thoughtful and incredibly bullish. He's a quite interesting character. He went away, and then I thought, oh, well, that's that. Let's just go back to building the house. And, you know, I've got to get a family for my kids. And I had a million things I was thinking about. I was not trying to start a business. And he came back after a few weeks with quite a lot of research he'd done across the whole cold brew market, iced coffee, so on and so forth. And he said, all right, let's do it. And I nearly had a heart attack. And I said, well, all right, I guess we're going to do it then.
But did you get the drywall done?
That was it. We got the drywall. We did get the drywall done. Yeah, we did get the drywall done. The family moved in. The story was a happy one.
Okay, so, I mean, it's one thing to decide that you're going to do fast-moving consumer goods, but it's another thing to actually develop it and fund it. How did you fund it in the early days? Did you get money from friends and family? Did you get an angel investor? Was it your own savings? What did you use?
So we all put in some money that we had all saved, enough to create a MLP, we call it, the most lovable product we could make rather than the minimum viable product.
Oh, I love that.
Minimum lovable product that we all liked, and we actually got a Tetra Pak sort of run done. So we'd sort of done all that exploration of the parameters of what we wanted and where we thought it was going to be. And then we produced a run with our own money, and we had a little bit of runway. And then we went out and we all hit the streets and we tried to sell that everywhere we could into grocery stores and corner shops and cafes and all over town.
And the market said, yes, give us more.
The market said, what the F is this? was mostly what they said at the time. It was a cold brew in a Tetra Pak. It was the cutest design too. It was absolutely amazing. And again, the designer who sort of made this iconic brand that Minor Figures is, he was also part of the original design. That's I should plug them. They're called Stevenson Edwards now. At the time, it was just a friend. And we went out. We tried to spruik it. It was almost a commercial failure. Well, it was a total commercial failure. However, what happened was that the cold brew market, let's call it this cold brew category, was kicking off in America, and it was all cold chain, meaning the cold distribution, so cold trucks, cold everything had to be refrigerated. And we were the only company in the world that had produced a delicious shelf-stable version. So almost immediately, a lot of the soft drink companies and a lot of the big companies came to us once they saw this
really
and tasted
interesting.
It. Yeah, and said, what are you doing? How are you doing this? What are you up to? And I think I can probably say it now, but at the time, maybe I can't, but I will anyway. Maybe it's a scoop, but a not very interesting one, I'll admit. At the time, Lavazza came to us and said, how is this possible? What have you guys been doing?
So would you like to hand over your intellectual property to us, please?
pretty much. Well, we were so naive and young. We just produced product for them and they put it under their brand for a little while, and that was what kept the business afloat for really the first couple of years. So it was sort of private labelling in the early days, this product.
All right. So you've got the cold brew and it's doing pretty well if Lavazza's, you know, badging it for you and what happens. And now you develop a completely different product. How does that happen?
So what we're, again, jumping ahead, we're really known for making oat milk now. But at the time, we decided that the mass market didn't, you know, cold brew was too niche for the mass market. So it needed to be more of an iced coffee, which was kind of following the original plan. We just didn't really like dairy. And it has got a lot of complications and compliance issues if you really want to scale that globally. So we then looked at plant-based milk and we looked at all the different options. And then we really playing with oat. And the guy who really created a lot of our products, a guy called James Wise, an absolute darling of a man, he was sort of had this very strange coffee shop in Melbourne, and Oatly kept going into him and getting him to talk through product. And he kept coming back to us saying, oat's really good. It's a really good product for coffee. It doesn't have that many additives. It's sort of made more of an emulsion, so it gets a very clean flavor profile of the cup. And you really should look at this.
When you say you played with it, you mean you went to a developer and you made lots of different ones, or you did it in your kitchen? What do you mean you played with it?
Probably more in the kitchen, yeah.
That's really interesting. So what do? Do you just stick it in a blender and see what happens? How do you play with it in your kitchen?
That isn't how you make oat milk, but that's probably how we played with it at the start. And we probably went and we sourced some different versions and we sourced some of the primary ingredient, let's say, the oat base, and we started to muck around in the kitchen. So that's how we would do it. And we probably blended oats as well. Like, it was a probably pretty messy period. I think the thing to think about when you add milk to coffee is that it has to have a certain flavor profile that people expect in milk, which is a sort of a body which is rich. It has to have a sweetness, which milk's very, very sweet. Dairy milk's very, very sweet. It has to buffer the acids in coffee, which is really, really important. And getting that, the balance of all those things right is very difficult. And then it has to be stable. So then you have to, you know, it can't split, it can't do this, it can't do that. And then you have to make latte art with it. So to actually have a product can do all of these things, I would say, is naturally the right word. More inherent to the product, oat covers a lot of those things easily, much more easily than soy or almond. And so you don't need to add all the stabilization and the additives and the emulsifiers and all that extra stuff in to keep, say, almond in suspension or a product from splitting. So, again, what we were trying to do when I say play with it was we were trying to get the balance of acidity, sweetness, texture, and the ability for it not to split, and the ability to make great latte art.
Okay, so you've got your coffee product happening. I mean, you've got Lavazza, you've got other things happening, and now you've got oat milk. What happens next? How did you switch from one to the other, or did you? Have you got a coffee business in the, you know, percolating away in the background?
No, our original product was we did actually produce the oat for the coffee product, so we had ready to drink cans. That's where we began.
Wow.
So we were a company that's created a ton of firsts. We created the first sort of shelf stable cold brew in the world, which was in the Tetra Pak, and then we created a widgeted nitro oat milk, which was kind of the first.
Okay,
of its
a
kind
widgeted
in the world.
Nitro oat milk. What is that? Explain it.
So when we were looking at oat, we develop an oat that goes in coffee, and what the market says is alternative milk is trying to replicate dairy milk. So it replicates it in mouthfeel, flavor, profile, buffering, all the things we sort of discussed that happen in coffee. They even tend to put the same nutritional profile into plant-based milk as they do to dairy. So they replicate the nutritional profile of dairy, which is quite weird to me because you can make it from scratch. So you can actually put any nutritional profile you want in plant-based. And because they try to replicate dairy, we never tried to replicate dairy. We actually don't give a shit about milk. We couldn't care less. We were actually trying to.
Okay.
We were trying to create the best cup of coffee.
Clear brand position there.
yeah, exactly. I mean, it's quite ironic that we're now in the milk game because we were trying to create the highest quality cup. Specialty coffee means a ton of things, but one of the things it means is that you support the growers and the agricultural end, and you invest and you help them create a better quality bean, let's say, or a cherry, and you sort of sort it and you process it the right way, and you take out all the bullets and the bones and a lot of the defects that you'd find in commodity coffee. And the reason you do that is so that you can roast the coffee lighter. And if you can store it and you can ship it and then you can roast it lighter, then you can have a whole new flavor profile that you wouldn't traditionally have got in commodity coffee. Commodity coffee, because of all those things that I mentioned, the defects and all these things, and generally the way they want to keep it consistent, they tend to roast it all incredibly dark. And that's, I guess it's part of the reason. That's not the whole story, but that's part of the reason why they have a sort of similar dark profile, whereas specialty coffee is about the origin, and it's about the seasonality, and it's about the flavor profiles, which is super different across the world, depending on the terroir and all sorts of stuff. So what our product tries to do, what Minor Figs product tries to do, be faithful to the growers so that if you have a lemony Guatemalan coffee, you should be able to detect that in your flat white. And if you have a hazelnut Brazilian, more traditional coffee, sort of cacao notes from Brazil or Colombia, you should be able to detect that in your coffee. And if it's a stone fruits from Africa, you should be able to detect that in your coffee a little bit. You shouldn't spend all that time creating all those flavor profiles and then adding milk or any alternative milk, which shrinks those flavor profiles down. So that's how we began the business. And that was the product we designed for our ready-to-drink range. And the ready-to-drink range launched after our Tetra Pak range. We superseded it with I called up a company that made a widgeted can in Netherlands, and they had just split from Ball Packaging. You had the Guinness widget, and they said, "Oh, we've got this can. It's funny you call. We want to put a product in it." I said, "Well, here we go. We can make a oat milk cold brew for this product." And so we went out and developed that with them.
So were you introducing it to the market through the distribution model you already had, or did you have to find new ways to bring it to market?
We didn't really have on the Tetra Pak, on our first original product, we didn't really have that much distribution. It was a product that was sort of limping along a little bit. So it was more just the developing and the building on all of the relationships that we'd already begun. Although I wouldn't say it was an easy win for this either. It was almost a massive upgrade in terms of the product. And probably, as I said, when you add milk to it, you kind of now broaden your
So at this early stage, you've got this product, it's got a can. Were you going around hand selling it to people, or how did you sell it?
Well, you've got to go through distributors. So there is the sort of double sell, let's call it, where you have to get your retailer to accept it and then you send it into the distributor. As most people in the industry will know, there's a couple of ways to do that. But often when you're a startup, you really need to pull it through the distributor. So you need to sell it to the end user. So whether it's a corner shop or a grocery store or whoever it is, you've got to get them to want it and want to list it, and then they can talk to the distributor and say, "Hey, can you list this product for me?" And then you have to then go and resell it to the distributor.
That's so interesting. In wine, which is what I mostly report on, it works the other way around, that you get the distributor and the distributor then puts it in store. But you're saying it's different. You've got to get the demand first before you can get the distributor.
Yeah. In my experience, absolutely. Yeah, I don't think the distributor would – they're not going to bother to have a product sit in their warehouse. They just can't afford it and not have anyone to sell it to. There's probably a difference, particularly for new SKUs and new products. They probably, in this industry, there's more snacks, and they have some chips, and they have some, granola bars, and they probably have a whole range of products that they've got in stock. So they want to make sure they can shift it. So in this experience, yes, definitely more of a pull strategy than a push strategy.
Okay, so you're in the UK, but you also sold to Australia and other places. How did you get it international? Was this already existing contacts, or did you have to start from scratch?
It was a little bit of both. Partly the vision of having a global and shelf stable and all those things, we were set up to then export it. Not having dairy, which requires compliance in a whole bunch of countries. A lot of the decisions that we probably made in the relationship with co-packers and Tetra Paks that we were sort of developing and building, and obviously we had now the can, and we sort of had built up a ton of experience, although it was a pretty short time. We built up a lot of experience to in order to do that. And again, my business partner, Johnny, who I had met when we started the business, he then, I think maybe he had a baby. Did he ever?
That's kind of important. You need to know that.
I can't remember the timelines. Hang on a second. But whatever happened, he said, "All right, I'm having a baby. I'm going back to it." Or I think he had his baby. And he said, "Look, we're going to go back to Australia now." And I said, "Oh, what? Are we going to?" I mean, in my head, it was like, "Well, that's it. We'll close the business down." At this stage, we're still tiny. We'd only really just started. So he took off and said, "No, why don't I just sell it in Australia," which was one of our, you know, probably in the scheme of things ranked as a medium of our crazy ideas, but at the time was completely bonkers. So he went down there and I think we were sending pallets into his garage, and he was sort of doing the same thing that we did, you know, 6 months earlier or a year earlier, where he was walking around the street selling it into retailers.
This is a key point. So you weren't making it in Australia, you were shipping it from the UK. Or do you still do that, or do you find it's easier to make it locally?
It's much easier to make it locally. You've got to really prove out the market, though. I guess the buzzword would be product market fit. Once you've sort of worked that out and you've got that and you have the volume, then you can go to you can go and get made locally. But in the early stages, you can't split the – because these run sizes are so massive, you can't sort of split them. You don't have enough customers or enough volume yet. It took us quite a long time to produce locally. So we produce now in UK, in Sweden, in Toronto, in Utah, and we have a co-packer who's licenses our brand in Australia, in Ballarat.
You produce in Utah. Okay, tell me the story of how you ended up in Utah.
Well, I mean, you can ask Mr. Trump with his tariffs. That's how we ended up in Utah. We were quite happy making it in Canada. So that's a recent operation where we've had to scramble with, you know, obviously we've had 5 years of sort of crazy macro environment for business, and I sort of tipped my hat to anybody who's still around and survived it, because it's been absolutely crazy. COVID, supply chain, energy crisis, inflation, you know, the sort of madness that we've had to face has been quite crazy. And then we come out of all that and all of a sudden there's tariffs on, tariffs off, tariff here, tariff there. For somebody who exports the business, and I also feel the pain of anybody who got caught in that. We were producing in Toronto for the entire US market, and then the tariffs became a threat, and we sort of did a fire drill, let's say, a couple of fire drills, and found a co-packer in Utah who could produce our product.
Okay, let's go back a step. So you entered the US market in 2018, I think, and I read somewhere that there was a great oat milk shortage, and that's how you – can you tell the story?
Yes, we were producing – so we had produced the cans. The cans were going very well. And off the back of the cans, almost as an afterthought, we produced the oat milk in a 1 litre. It was partly because we had the relationship with the Tetra and so on and so forth. So we weren't really focused on oat milk as its own product. We were focused on the RTDs, the ready-to-drink iced coffee range. And I think we had a cold brew black, which was completely delicious, nitro. We had a latte. We had a mocha. And I think we had a matcha as well. So we had a range of 4 cans. You can probably find them somewhere on the internet. Again, with this iconic sort of branding, which I don't know, you tend to see that now a little bit everywhere, but it was a range of characters, which was quite sweet. And then we produced the 1 litre oat milk. Yeah, as I said, almost because it was such a great product and we thought it would be interesting. Oat milk had not taken off yet. So we were thinking it was still going to be very niche for niche cafes, niche specialty who wanted to showcase the characters of their espresso. Like that's what it's designed to do. So we're going into cafes saying, look, we spent all the money on this more, you know, higher acid, higher quality coffee. Like here's the product which you need to showcase. And I think, the big Swedish competitor did coffee very well. They went about it a bit differently. If you think of the market as sort of bull rings, the outside of the bull ring is the latte drinker. On the inside of that's the cafe, and then the really in the bullseye is the roaster. So the roaster is the sort of tastemaker, and they're the real influencer, and they're the ones who create the flavor profile and the experience for all their cafes that they wholesale to, and then obviously they sell to the latte drink. So there's several layers of consumer or customer you need to be able to talk to. Most milk companies, and particularly ones that have more money than God, were blasting the latte drinkers to drink oat milk, which was fortunate for us. And they were influencing the cafes, but they weren't necessarily influencing the roaster, because the alternative milk products and our competitive products aren't very faithful to the roaster's product. It is actually just another milk, whereas our product is more faithful to the roaster. So we dynamically went the other way. We would go to the roaster first and say, hey, can you quality control this, QC this product with your coffee? How do you feel? What do you think? It's a much cleaner profile. It's much cleaner on the tongue than on your teeth, and you have this real experience of the coffee, which is very, very clean. Anytime you add anything to sort of increase the body, you take away from the flavors. Anything you do to add something to make it more like milk, you take away from the coffee. And so we went in QC'd with the roasters, and once we got the roasters' approval, then we could go to their wholesale accounts. So we could actually go door-to-door to their cafes and say, hey, so-and-so's QC'd this, how about it? And then we were able to pick up counts in bunches. So it was a kind of dynamic way we went about selling that in the early days in UK. And as we were just doing our thing, you know, trying our best to get this product out into market and you know, a super, super startup, like incredible startup versus, again, these companies that are just absolutely enormous. We, yeah, 2018 happened and the great oat shortage of New York, let's call it, where New Yorkers were going crazy because they couldn't get oat milk. And a fella called us at the time, his name was Craig Weiser, an absolute legend, a diamond of a man. He had a distribution business and he was very kind of New York and he was on the phone to us. And I sort of still remember now, sort of Hackney Wick warehouse, talking to him. And he sort of said, I'll take in pallets a little bit like, and unbelievably, what also happened, which was very fortunate, is our co-packer here in Somerset had FDA approval for something else. So we probably couldn't have even shipped it in, but very sort of strangely at some point they'd got FDA. So we were able to ship into the US and he said, look, I cannot get oat milk anywhere. I sell to all these cafes. I need to get oat milk. We sent him a sample. He called us up. He said, I like it. I'll take it. No other company in the world made oat milk at that stage. It was only the Swedish company and us.
So what? I'm intrigued. What caused the great oat milk shortage?
I think just supply chain and the demand, just the popularity of it.
Okay. So you introduced this product at a time when everybody was going vegetarian and vegan. Did that help demand as well?
I think so. I think absolutely. Yeah, it was a real trend toward plant-based, which definitely helped the product. Yeah, I think obviously having a growing category is an absolute blessing.
Okay, so now you're in Canada, you're in the US, you're in all sorts of places. So have you expanded the range since then?
So we have expanded the range. We really just make barista products, essentially. We make a standard sort of hero product for specialty coffee. We make an organic version. And again, when you're talking about firsts for minor figures, we sort of made the shelf-stable cold brew. We made the widgeted iced coffees, oat lattes, which are the first in the world. And then we actually made an organic barista product, which is incredibly hard to do. For some reason, the additives or the process of non-organic allows a lot more stability, and an organic product is easily split and does not create latte art. So we then produced a standard, then again, another world first, a sort of barista organic oat milk.
How do you overcome those technical challenges? At this point, are you getting flavor scientists on board, or is it still experimenting in the kitchen, basically? How do you solve these problems?
With great luck and great difficulty, I think we've had, as we've gone to expand our range beyond that, we've had a lot more issues with product and stability and performance and all those things. When you're very small and very young and you're sort of scrambling and running very fast, most of the time we either papered over them or we got very lucky. We didn't really have a plan and we didn't have a food tech. I mean, we obviously brought in different agencies to kind of work with as contractors on an ad hoc basis, but we didn't really have anyone technical in the business up until probably about 8 months ago, 9 months ago.
Right. And I should ask you, what do you mean when you talk about widget cans? I've got no idea what this is. What is it?
Like the Guinness widget, so the nitrogen in the mm-hmm. Guinness, you know, they have that can. So this company, I think Refresco's bought them now, but they were called... the name escapes me. I think it was Dis at the time in the Netherlands. They had a widget which was like a top hat in the can, which was a sort of IP that they owned. And then they didn't have a product to go into it because I think Guinness or somebody else, there was some story around the contract. So they developed this for somebody and then they left the company was so big they got split in half. And so the product went the other way. So they had this can with no product in it. So what it was at the time was just a can and filled with nitrogen. So it was an experience of a iced coffee but with a sort of creamy Guinness head.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's so interesting. Okay, so when you grow internationally, especially like this, the the hardest thing for many companies is actually the point of expansion, because you've got to fund it, but you haven't earned any money yet. Now, I read that I think Danone's Manifesto Ventures and Hong Kong's Green Monday came on board. Can you talk about that? And what's it like working when you have to raise that kind of capital? How does it change the business?
Yeah, I think for us, so there's a sort of prior investment round with a New York fund. And that started, I sort of was halfway through the great oat shortage, where Craig Weiser brought this product in from the UK, and he sort of said, look, I'll buy it from you now. And we said, okay, no problem. And then I said, look, you're going to have to pay us up front because we don't know who you are. So he said, all right, we'll do this deal. And we gave him a discount, and he said, no problem, I'll take it. And then we said, how many sort of pallets do you want us to send you? And he said, oh, look, I think I'll take, I don't know, 4 containers a week.
So wow.
When I say it was an oat shortage, it was an oat shortage. So we expected 1 or 2 pallets a month, and he was talking about 4 containers a week, and it might have even got to 6 containers a week. So not only that, because we had the upfront payment deal, he was sort of funding the productions, because we obviously were tiny. We had no money. We were totally tiny. We couldn't do it. So this CLW was a company at the time. So they produced his products, shipped it into the US and all across the US. And what we didn't realize was they were master distributors for the coffee industry. So the product went all over national in America. And then within sort of 3 to 4 months, the competitors either got their supply chain together. Some competitors produced the product in order to fill that demand as well. They scrambled to bring a product to market. And so within 4 or 5 months, there was a whole bunch of different competitors there. Minor Figures was there without any representation, nobody in the market, no nothing. And we obviously got squeezed a little bit. So we ended up with quite patchy, but still enormous distribution in America. So it was, again, super, super lucky, very blessed. And then a character who is an unbelievable character who came was a vegan. And
owned by a vegan. That's hilarious.
He's a New York hedge fund sort of billionaire who was a vegan. So it was even more niche. And he had a coffee somewhere on holiday. I think it was, we're saying Richmond, Virginia, but there's a bit of a dispute where he had it. And he said, this is the best coffee I've ever had. He obviously ordered an oat milk latte. He said, what is the oat milk you guys are using? And the barista showed him the packaging, and being this sort of incredible character who has a nose for things that he likes, he said, he called his fund in New York and said, let's invest in
that. What's the fund?
Product. They're called, I don't know if they'd like me saying, but I might not
okay,
say
can you
that.
Say
I'm not
how
sure
much
how.
They put into it?
Yeah, so they flew someone from New York to come and see us. So we were just like, I mean, we had people in London wouldn't even come up to Hackney Wick to come and see us, or where we're now in Walthamstow. They would, you know, not even bother. And then all of a sudden we had a hedge fund flying out from New York. They spent 2 days with us. And then at the time we sort of were talking about how much we needed, and we sort of put a number on the table of $1 million or sort of $2 million or something like this, thinking it was big dollars. And they said, oh, no, this what you guys are crazy. You guys are going to be massive. How about we give you sort of $6 million or something like this? So it was like, what?
Let's just talk this through. I mean, there is such a big difference in the way that people in Europe or UK and the people in America think about money. You know, it's very typical that people underprice themselves when they go to the US market. But $6 million is a lot of money, and it changes everything. Was it a scary number? Was it exciting? Or was it like what's it like when somebody offers you that much money?
I think it is scary. It doesn't come for free. There's no free kicks. So it's definitely an interesting experience. And I would say our experience is very unique, and has been excellent. They have been, this New York partner has been such great partners for us.
Well, it sounds like you're dealing with somebody who loves the product rather than is looking at it from a balance sheet point of view.
Yeah, loves the product, loves the brand, really likes us, really likes the whole story, and I guess is not, looking at in the terms of the sort of pennies. Like, again, America's just so, and New York particularly, is just so ambitious in their approach to everything that it's just a whole different
mentality. And how did having an injection of that much cash change things?
Well, part of it was that they wanted us to come to the US more, because we obviously had – was just shipping pallets through this one distributor into the US. So they said, oh, well, why don't we, you know, attack US retail? It's obviously a huge market. Here's the money, come to the US. So the money came in 20, and it was at the time, I don't know the exact number, I'm going to say £6 million. And we, part of it was to launch in the US. So we hired a bunch of people and sort of set up warehousing, and we're flying back and forth and trying to get a bit of a team together. And we did that, you know, the money came in 2019, let's say. It was the end of 2018. So 2019, the money came in, began to deploy that money through 2019. So quite a lot of that money, and we're a profitable business at this stage, but then began to deploy that money into that market. And then, you know, 9 months later, COVID had hit, all the cafes had closed, and there was a team there. I hadn't even met half of them in person. And we didn't know anything in the warehousing, and I mean, the whole thing went to chaos. So
what happened? How did you get through that period?
With, again, a bit of, you know, fair weather, a bit of luck, and a lot of sort of hard graft. I think for us, we, you know, one of the crazy, interesting stories and scary stories was that we'd just taken on, obviously, this investor, and They were good to us, but they were, of course, you know, making sure we were sort of pushing the business forward in the right way. And they were, we were aligned on our mission. So there wasn't any disagreements or anything, but of course they're across our business quite hard. And we, when COVID hit, we had a package called Zero. Everybody will know this accounts package, you know, most startups, which is very good, but it has a certain number of transactions you can do a day. And we were doing around online, we might've been doing £4,000 a month on subscription for people subscribing to Oat. You know, roughly around that every month. So it was pretty manageable, and the rest was through, you know, distribution. And, you know, so January's 4,000, February's 4,000, COVID hits, March, whatever, it, maybe it was March, and it was, March was 250,000. April was 370,000. I think we topped out near about $500,000 a month, which then broke our accounts package. So on top of having a team in the US that we couldn't see and couldn't get a handle on it, didn't know what the hell was happening, we snapped our accounts package, which ran our, which then we took months and months and months to actually build it back up and have it sort of
linking
again. Yeah,
it's like podcasting. So when you get to 500 episodes, the whole thing stops working. You know, there's a limit on it. So how did you solve the problem?
Well, it took months to solve the problem. So there was no, I don't think we had a management pack come out for, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 months.
Did you manage
we didn't know anything about our cash flow.
Did you manage to fulfill the orders? I mean, how did you do that in a pandemic?
Orders were still going out. Yeah, orders were still going out. Things were happening, but we just had no idea of the business health, the balance sheet, the cash flow, what the P&L looked like. We didn't have any idea. And we had to kind of bring in almost a cash flow specialist to try and help us understand our cash flow at this time through this period, which was just a mad period. But anyway, of course, we survived that. We managed it and sort of lived to tell the tale. But
okay, so then in 2022, if the media is correct, there's more injections of cash. Did you go out to raise money? Did the hedgie in New York say it's time you people went off and made some money? Or how did that come about?
Yeah, so we were running a loss-making business for growth, and we were setting up our markets, and we really had three growth vectors, the Asia-Pac region, America and Europe, and that's expensive and very, very difficult to set up. Like, I definitely would advise people to be very cautious about exporting and setting up different businesses, because it is super treacherous. We happened to get lucky, and this category was absolutely exploding. So there was a lot of tailwinds, which we were grateful for. And it's still, we only just made it with the skin of our teeth. So we were running a loss-making business, which was, when you're doing that, you've got a cash burn, you've got a runway, and you've got a growth number that you're sort of measuring it off. And that was all going okay. Like, I would say, like, we were growing really fast. We were sort of growing 40, 50% year on year, maybe even more, 60% year on year for a couple of years in a row. And then the pandemic, of course, was sort of, that all happened, and that was a messy period, and we're still growing fast, probably burning more cash, but the growth was still quick. And then when we came out of the pandemic thinking it was okay, we definitely needed cash. So we raised money, with DMV, who've been a great partner. So they came on board with the idea that, actually, to be honest, and again, we thought that they would be a very good partner, because who better to help us than Danone with a multi-regional, multi-product plant-based business? It ends up there's quite a lot of red tape and bureaucracy between the investment arm and actually Danone. So a lot of the pain we were facing, we couldn't really get help with from the mothership. Nonetheless, they were very good to us. And
Danone is French as well, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, DMV's out of New York, but right. Danone's a French, yeah, big French company. And we chose them over a few other different options because they were the world's biggest B Corp at the time. The CEO was very heavy on sustainability. I think they have even another certification which is more sustainable. So we kind of like the operational side and then the sustainability ethos of Danone. So that's why we chose them over several other options. And then really, again, probably the second period was after that where really we saw the inflation and the supply chain and actually there was a sort of secondary compounding and then the category began to slow as well. So that was the period after that was actually the most challenging for our business.
And how did you get through that?
Well, we definitely burnt way too much cash is probably the one thing. Like we had a growth story and a burn story and it didn't line up. So again, with help from investors and sort of leaning into a lot of the things we did well, we obviously had tons of runway because we'd raised a bit of money. So we were able to get through it basically with that. And now the business, is in another period again. So we've sort of come out of that.
Now there's the tariffs. So sum up where you are right now.
As a business in terms of?
Yeah.
Size and
So I looked you up, and in 2023, the UK financials said about 31.8 million in revenue. It also said there was a 10 million loss. So that was 2 years ago. So where do things stand now?
Yeah, this year will be 40 million and roughly break even.
Wow.
I think we're going to record a small loss. And then really going into our financial year is actually starting in a couple of weeks. So the financial year we're going into.
The Australian financial year.
Yeah, we're on the Aussie financial year, yeah. So we shall be profitable in the coming year.
All right, so it's an amazing story. When you look back at all of that, what would you do differently?
I don't know. There's only one way to do it. These people who start businesses are a typical breed, but I'm certainly not necessarily want to take advice from. I think the three founders were absolute pain sponges. We were able to take more pain than is humanly possible. And I think that's okay for a first time, it was a very different business to Keep Cup. So Keep Cup was a dream because the product never went off, there was no shelf life, and the margins were enormous. And once you get rolling with the sort of production side of it, it's a super cash accretive business. And I went into food and drink a bit naive, thinking, oh, my God, this is going to be a walk in the park. And the wafer-thin margin at the end you get, I couldn't even comprehend how this industry even works. So that's a challenge in food and drink. But what would I do differently is the question. I don't know.
You don't have to say anything. You could go, nope, I did everything right all the way through.
We definitely didn't do everything right. We're still not doing everything right. I think that's okay, though. I don't know if I look back what we would have done differently. We were so blessed and there were so many twists and turns that it's been a bit of a roller coaster as most businesses are.
I think the business lesson here is have contact with Stuart because obviously you just attract good luck. There's a lot of luck in this story.
There is a lot of luck. I mean, when I write my business story, Felicity, this business story will be one page and it'll say, I timed it well, the end.
Okay, so on a last note, you've critiqued coffee leadership. You've called oat milk the biggest story in coffee and because there's been a void in coffee leadership. What would genuine leadership look like?
Well, I think we came through a period of great innovation and really forging forward with a lot of ideas within coffee. And I say that tongue in cheek, please coffee roasters and all my coffee friends, please don't get mad. I used to joke about that in a couple of years ago with a lot of coffee roasters that the biggest thing in sort of coffee was oat milk. And it probably, to be honest, it probably was. But we go through the second wave, what the Americans call the third wave, and then really what I was challenging people to think through is what is the fourth wave? Like what are we going to be focusing on? Where's our attention going to be? How will the market grow, survive, innovate? And really at its best, coffee is much more of a community than an industry. It's an incredible place to work. It's a funny one because there's this enormous almost industrial machine, which is almost unimaginable, the size of this thing from the grower's end all the way through, like all this coffee that's got to be processed and, you know, sort of washed and then sorted and bagged and then stored and then shipped and then exported and imported and roasted, and then all this enormous hands that it passes through. It's just this phenomenal, if you can sort of picture it, it's a phenomenal chain of people that then ends up with a barista who makes a product and hands it to you right at the very end, and you get to drink it in front of them. It's an unbelievably intimate experience, coffee, ultimately, for me. So I've always like been very allured into the industry itself, and I'm very keen to see and very keen to push and pursue, you know, people who know the industry probably better than I do, way better than I do, I should say. What's going to happen next?
Okay, so final advice. What advice would you give somebody who wants to start a beverage product, particularly somebody who wants to start something that is new with all the challenges that comes with establishing a category?
Two things spring to mind, and I probably could have prepared better for this answer, but two things spring to mind. One is it is very expensive to grow a category. It is unbelievably expensive. So if you are looking to do something very, very new, that is a challenge. And the only way around that is to link that very closely to a community. So some of the best products and probably bootstrap products that have sort of broken through have been intrinsically linked to a community. I'm thinking RX Bar out of the US. Obviously, that was a CrossFit protein bar, but they really just lasered in and they just went after CrossFit and nothing else for, I think, the first 4 years. And it was only in their last year before they exited that they began to go into retail. So they were really laser focused on the customer, the consumer type. And that was a protein bar. So that wasn't even anything necessarily new. So I think new categories are expensive. Focusing heavily on a customer or a community that you can talk to. And that means you probably have to know them. Like, you can't fake that. You do have to be authentic with that. And then really the other one that sticks out is how many channels can you sell the product in? If it's purely grocery, that's okay, let's say, but it's very, very, grocery is incredibly expensive and the margins are thin, as everyone sort of talks about. If you have another channel, let's say D2C and grocery, or you have, In our case, it's D2C, grocery, and cafes, food service. So you're on-premise channel. So we're able to span three channels, two of them very well, one not so. I guess oat milk's not a particularly good D2C product, but it's still, we have a good subscriber base connecting with us. So think about your channel strategy.
Stuart, do you make different products for different channels so that people don't get upset about price?
We don't. No, we don't. We often go back and forward on NPD, what is the right approach to NPD. And I think now we're quite big. We obviously want to bring this kind of exciting texture, the sort of minor figures, or the minorverse, we sort of call it, this exciting, incredible, quite elastic brand, let's say. I mean, I don't necessarily see this as oat milk. I think we could stretch into all sorts of things. So we're kind of this tension in our business between the push and pull. Let's not go too far away from our core. Let's, you know, continue to produce products which, you know, are commercial and provide money. And also you got to give some texture to people as well. So we'll end up, I guess I always say, we don't really sell oat milk at minor figures. We sell attitude, because you can actually get oat milk from anyone now. In the early days, it was just us and someone else. But now anyone can make oat milk, or at least a lot of people. The barriers to entry are a lot lower. So why would they come to us? Well, it's for the attitude that we're trying to communicate.
I should ask, where did the name Minor Figures come from?
I think I rushed it, would be my answer. I think, again, I might have been inhaling too much too much drywall.
That was the problem.
Yeah, the idea was, there's a few pork pies we tell about that, a few lies, but the original idea was that, when we go back to the original idea, it was iced coffee that was specialty coffee that was in the grocery store. And I think what we wanted to do was, Minor Figures was the idea that we would be the platform and we would have different coffee roasters roast coffee for this product that we would then sort of ship and sell and distribute into all these grocery stores. So, you know, you could find it wherever you went and shopped. And as soon as we went with the name and, you know, spoke to some coffee roasters who could produce the coffee for us, and then we actually spoke to some of the big grocery chains, they were like, that's the craziest idea we've ever heard. You can't change your ingredient, change your flavor profile sort of every 3, 4, 6 months. This is not going to work. Like, we can't list, we can't even list this product. So we ended up with a name that kind of didn't quite match the original or part of the original brief. But I still think it was also a nod to sort of humble, kind of eccentric lives. We were sort of produced at a time where everyone was sort of, you know, this rah-rah rise and grind and, you know, all these people that were kind of going out there and telling you how they woke up at 4 a.m. and all that sort of stuff. And I think for us, we didn't really care about that. Like, if you want to get up at 4 a.m. and, you know, try and become the next president, good luck. We're there for you. And if you want to sit on the couch and smoke bongs, we're there for you too. Like, we don't mind, you know. So
I guess how old are you, Stuart?
I am 47.
So you, I just heard the Gen X slacker speaking. Final thoughts.
I don't know.
One final question. Where do the oats come from?
So the oats come locally. So wherever we produce them, we get them from. For a while, we were getting all Northern Europe and UK oats. Originally, because we had a high volume. Now I think we've got UK oats for UK, European oats for Europe, and US and North American oats.
So you've got oat milk terroir.
Yeah. And actually, I mean, one of the interesting things, again, for the UK, we are looking at that. I won't give too much away, but we have some new products coming out that we are looking at that very much. Yeah, getting really interested in that. There's something quite interesting about coffee has the language of single estate. It went from sort of Robusta, and then we knew what Arabica was, and that was like a high quality coffee. And then it went to single origin or single estate, which was meant even higher quality. And often you'd have the farm and the elevation and the grower and everything. And I think for us, there's something quite sweet about the idea that we could try that with oats as well. So there's some stuff in the pipe coming.
All right. Well, Stuart, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thanks so much, Felicity.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome. Thank you.